Tell me what you need done, and I'll prove my good intentions. But if you're stringing me along, expect to regret it. Well, now, threats aren't going to help us build our bridge across our gap of trust, are they? All I need is a couple of letters. Easy stuff. Get them, and we'll go from there. Dante stood. I'll have them in an hour. Casey eyed him. Awfully confident. Faith in my team. Then go on and impress me. Horace, fill him in on the details. A middle-aged man with a shaved head and a thoughtful look detached from the wall and intimated Dante and the others follow him inside. At the front room, he stopped to speak in low tones.
A few weeks ago, we became aware of a man named Julin. Casey believes he's here to scout for the minister, but we have no hard evidence. We know he's sending and receiving a great deal of letters, but he never leaves his house. Waylaying one of his messengers would tip him off. He'd change up everything. However you steal his letters, he must not be made aware you've done it.
He won't be, Dante said. Horace nodded, opened the front door, and let them outside. Do you understand why she has assigned this to you?
Because we're here.
Because we don't have any links to Casey or her people, C said. If we screw up, it's all on us.
Be sure to keep it that way.
Horace gave them the address, including the floor and room. Dante made sure he had it memorized, then headed for the stairs up to the city proper.
You're sure this is the right move?
C said once they'd put the house behind them.
Of course not.
But at least it's a move.
This isn't some desperate lurch into darkness, Dante said. This is exactly where Yotam sent us.
It's moving a little fast.
You'd rather it were going slow.
We'll knock off this little errand in minutes. Then we'll see what Casey has to tell us about Selin.
Fair enough, C said. About that errand, how do you intend to sneak into a home the owner never leaves?
I won't.
Dante pointed to the dead rat padding along at his side.
She will.
It's kind of cheating when you use magic, C muttered. They reached the stairs. Up top, he lowered the false floor, climbed into the dark room, and cast about, poking at the frieze to try to figure out how to lift the trapdoor into position. After 2 minutes of this, Ast pointed out the metal chain at the edge of the door, which could be used to pull it back up. Once the door was raised, a tile clicked into place, concealing the chain. Outside, Dante waved at the roof. Somber and Lou joined them in the alley. Dante quickly laid out what they'd seen below ground, along with their new task.
I know you won't like it, he told Somber, but right now, our other option is poring through 2,000 pages of a very old book written in a foreign language that might not make a single reference to what we're after.
Somber chuckled in his unsettling way.
What isn't there to like about throwing ourselves into the middle of an internecine conflict?
We'll only get deep enough to extract the information we need.
Don't get so focused on using this woman that you fail to notice she's using you.
To Dante's surprise, Somber recognized the name of the street housing the suspected agent of the minister. Dante sent Lou and Ast running back to the inn, then set off to locate Julin's domicile. It was a row house, in a part of town that was neither too shabby nor too chic. Some of the intersections even had lanterns hanging from poles. Despite the lateness of the hour, talk filtered from a public house at the corner, along with the music of an instrument that sounded like a fiddle, but with a metallic undercurrent Dante had never before heard. They circled around the building to confirm they had the right room. The windows were shuttered, but on the top floor, Julin's floor, the balcony door was cracked. Dante sent Sombor down the street to keep watch, then went into the public house, taking C with him to watch over him. As soon as they were seated, he sent the rat into the street and delved into its eyes. It loped outside and bounded to the side of the building. The structure was faced with rough stone. The rat had no problem scrambling straight up, clawing its way to Julin's balcony. It gazed into the dim apartment and slipped inside. A candle flickered across the room. A man hunched over a desk, quills scratching away. Maps hung on the walls. In one corner, a bin overflowed with chicken bones, old rice, wadded paper, and fruit pits. Two live rats were already there, gnawing furtively. His rat prowled, taking in the scene. The man continued to write. 15 minutes later, he blotted his ink, shook off the sand, blew on the papers, and set them aside while he went to the other room to relieve himself in a pot. Dante moved the rat to a dark corner. The man returned, examined the papers, and stored them in the desk's top drawer. He blew out the candle and lay on the mattress across the room. The man was breathing evenly before Lou and Ast came into the public house, bearing Dante's writing implements. As soon as they'd arrived, he sent the rat up to the top of the desk. It wedged its paws inside the drawer and pushed it open with a soft squeak of wood. The man didn't stir. The rat clenched the corners of the papers in its teeth, dragged them out, trotted to the balcony, and ascended to the street, where Somber had positioned himself to intercept. He brought the papers to the pub, and Dante and Lou copied them as quickly as they could. Finished, Somber walked the rat back to the row house, and it returned the papers to the desk, closing the drawer as best it could. The whole thing took a few minutes longer than the hour Dante had estimated, but it was among the easiest jobs he'd ever pulled. On the way back to the door, to the secret underground, he tried to read what he'd stolen, but it was too dark to make out many of the words, and what he could catch seemed rambling and quotidian. After he'd accidentally stepped in his third puddle, he rolled up the papers and pocketed them. This time, he took the whole group below, but left Lou and Somber several blocks away from the abode of Casey Gage. As Dante approached it, the door opened. Horace ushered them inside. Dante produced the papers. "He was writing a letter when I got there. This is a copy of it." Horace took the pages, glancing between them and Dante. "How did you get this?" "I suppose I'll tell you that when Casey tells me what I want to know." He flapped the letter against his thigh.
"She will be extremely pleased with this. Wait here."
He retreated into the home, which was more shadowed and hushed than it had been on Dante's previous visit a few hours earlier. Horace returned in moments.
"She is pleased with the news," he said, "but not with the hour. She requests that you return at noon, after she has had time to sleep and look over your findings."
Dante was a bit miffed at being turned away, but he was tired enough to be relieved that the end of the night was in sight. "Before I go, will you at least tell me what this place is?"
"You mean the Echoes?"
Horace gestured around the caverns.
"This is where the city used to be, long ago."
"No offense, but why does anyone still live down here? You do realize there's a perfectly usable sun upstairs, right?"
"Some are here because they think the city above is an illusion. The history of Ellen is invasion and strife. It has never been safe there. Some day it will be torn down to the foundation, and the careless, oblivious citizens will be torn down with it."
He smiled slightly. "Or so they believe."
"Why are you here?"
He smiled foxily.
"There is some business the people don't want to see, and there is other business we don't want them to see."
"I'm guessing your group tends toward the latter."
"I believe we are a mixture of both."
Horace stepped back from the door.
"Good night."
Dante went back to the stairs again, collecting Lou and Somber along the way. He told them what little there was to tell. Everyone must have been as tired as he was, because for once there were no objections or complaints. They returned to the inn straight away. Once Dante woke, he spent the morning paging through the Cycle of Geron. Ideally, he would have been skimming it for mention of Selen, or absorbing enough of its theology to have a real conversation with Mickle and try to tap his wisdom on the matter. But between his tired mind and his genuine excitement about this divergence from everything he held true, he read through the early sections it shared with Aron to determine if they were worded differently. With noon approaching, they headed down to the Echoes. The streets were visibly busier than the night before. There were even a few stalls selling food to those who called the caverns home. Not everyone wore grey scarves, and there were no guards or obvious controls over who came and who went. Dante thought the scarves might be nothing more than a way for people who lived here to identify each other when they ventured above, so they would know when they were in the presence of their own. This time, expecting useful information about Selen, he took Somber and Lou with them as well. One of Casey's people opened the door before he could knock. The man inspected Somber and Lou, then led all five of them to the back room. A minute later, Casey strode inside, offered them each a ritual sip of water, and whacked Dante in the chest with the papers. "This is great," she said. "It's so great, I want you to steal everything else he's got in there, too." "If you think that's the best use of my talents," Dante said. "Now, what about my info? For all I know, you're working with Julin and falsified these letters to trick me into thinking we're paddling the same way. Before my trust is bridged, I'm going to need more. Something that hurts them too bad to be a part of some gambit." "This is ridiculous. I can't control the content of the letters. All I can do is copy what's there. Did you get proof Julin is working with the minister?" Casey slumped a little. "Maybe." "Doesn't the minister already know about this Black Star thing?" C said. "If we were working with him, why would it matter if you tell us something he already knows?"
"He could have sent us to find out what they know," Somber said.
"Not helping." Dante glared at him, then attempted to smooth his expression as he turned to Casey. "We're both working toward the same ends. You said it yourself. If you think the Black Star is a part of his plans, it's in your interest to help me find it instead." She hissed air through her teeth. "You are going to owe me big." She nodded at Horace. "Take them upstairs." Horace moved to the door, motioning them to follow.
"I don't know as much about the Black Star as you might like, but all I know is yours to hear."
Chapter 22 Blaze laughed hard, then realized he shouldn't be laughing at all. He cleared his throat.
"Excuse me, but they've just totally and utterly screwed themselves."
Denny fought to keep the wrath from his face.
"By mutilating my son?"
"Yes, I'm very sorry about that, but they've given us the means to find him. Do you still have the finger?"
"I wouldn't throw out a part of my son."
Blaze was somehow able to refrain from asking what Denny intended to do with it otherwise. He screwed up his face. "Well, there is just no polite way to discuss this." He raised his eyebrows at Min. "Does he know what you do? With the dark stuff?"
"I'm sure he's heard rumors," she said.
"Which are always five times taller than the truth. There you go, then. All you have to do is track your cousin's blood back to the source."
"How do I do that?"
"You know, with the shadows. Same way Dante hunted me down."
"I don't know how to do that," Min said slowly. "I've never even heard of it. Maybe Ro could do it."
"Ro's not here," Blaze said. "I'm happy to try, but I'm as productive as a leech in your nose."
"I can try." She turned to Denny. "May I?"
Her uncle rolled his lips together.
"You're talking about sorcery?"
She eyed him calmly. Would that be a problem?
No.
He jerked his head to the side. Not if it helps find Cal.
Then I'm sorry to be macabre, Blay said, but we'll need to see the finger.
The man was spooked, but hid it well. He took them upstairs to a round room with a high ceiling and wraparound glass windows that gave a full view of the Black Lake. The chambers were outfitted with stuffed chairs, rich wooden bookshelves and desks, and a cabinet of bottles of myriad colors. In the house of your typical lord, all this would mark it as a private study, the tower to which the man of the house could retreat and survey his domain. But Denny was a merchant of Galador. Blaze knew enough to recognize the room as the businessman's equivalent of a war room. Denny moved to a desk, shoulders bowed, and retrieved a small wooden box. He held it out, glancing between Min and Blaze. Tears shined in his eyes. Min accepted it without eye contact and lifted its hinged lid. Her jaw went tight. She closed her eyes. Nether wafted to her hands. She sent it to the box, and it buzzed in confused spirals. It went still, then vibrated side to side. It paused a second time, then floated like tiny flakes of snow in a tumbling winter wind. Min stepped back, holding the box at arm's length.
I don't know what I'm doing.
That makes two of us, Blay said.
She wiped a sheen of sweat from her brow.
Did he ever tell you how to do this?
It rarely occurred to me to talk shop when he was raising zombies and making people's heads explode.
I think the concept is you find the nether in the blood, then follow it back to its source.
Makes sense.
In theory.
He laughed wryly.
Trust me, after what you've put me through the last couple of months, I understand how this feels.
Relax and see what you can do.
Annoyance flickered across her face. She breathed and the lines smoothed. Denny watched them the way Blaze might watch a barber bleeding a man whose cough has reduced him to a life in bed. Hopeful but nauseated, and not quite certain the supposed cure wasn't making things worse.
When she was ready, Min summoned the nether back to the box. It was visibly calmer, washing over what lay in the box, retracting, then rolling forward like midnight surf. For 10 minutes she stood in perfect concentration. The nether winked away. She staggered back, clutching her head. The box tipped from her hand.
Blaze darted in to catch it. Inside a bed of black velvet, a pale finger pointed at his heart.
I can't do it, Min said. I'm not making any progress at all.
What are you trying? Blaze said. When you follow the nether, where does it go?
I don't know. Maybe you should try.
Blaze glanced at Denny, who nodded his okay. Blaze gazed at the finger. Its stump was rusty with dried blood. The nether there was plentiful, flowing through severed veins and tickling along cut skin. He reached into it and tried to follow wherever it might lead, but the edge of the shadows blended into nothing, leaving him lost. Even so, he tried again and again, attacking the problem with every trick he'd honed in Pocket Cove. All failed to show him a thing. He sighed and set the box down on the desk.
I've got nothing.
Thank you for trying, Denny said, making a valiant effort to keep the disappointment from his face.
Well, just because the shadows quit on us doesn't mean we're done.
Blaze sat in a chair, its cushioned seat sinking beneath his weight. He rubbed his face.
We've got other tools in the kit, feet and brains. Why don't you tell us exactly what's happened?
Denny glanced at the knight, perhaps deciding whether he'd had enough of the day, then opened the cabinet and got out a pink bottle.
Blank? Min?
Blaze nodded. After a pause, so did Min. Denny poured 3 glasses with 2 inches of whitish liquid and distributed them. It tasted like anise and honey.
Blaze hadn't had anything stronger than tea and broth in months, but he forced himself to sip rather than guzzle. Then he seated himself and laid out the facts. Though he was more detailed in places, the relevant bits matched Min's version. Blaze swirled his drink. "They still haven't sent any demands?"
"They have not," Denny said. "I've seen this game at the negotiating table. The idea is to bring my nerves to a boil. Don't dangle the offer until I'm so exhausted I'll grab it like a lifeline."
"Any idea why they're so hell-bent on this book?"
"It's ancient, concerned with the machinations of the Celeset. The woman who wants it is from Narashtovik. It doesn't take a cartographer to map those shores."
Denny rubbed his palms together.
"But it makes little sense. Narashtovik was our ally during the Chainbreaker's War."
"Yeah, but these days a different brow wears the crown."
Blaze tapped his glass.
"Here's my thinking. Min, you keep trying to hunt the blood. Denny, can I call you Denny? You look into the courier who delivered today's message. See if you can trace him back to whoever hired him."
"And what will you be doing?"
"Me," Blaze said, "taking a nap."
Denny's eyebrows shifted together.
"Taking a... Sorry, I make odd jokes when I'm tired. This isn't my first trip to Galador. I know some people here. I'll visit them and see what I can turn up. Sound good?"
"Thank you for coming," Denny said.
He leaned forward and patted Min's knee.
"You too. I don't understand where you've been, but I know you must be risking much to be here."
"Then do me one favor," Min said. "Don't tell my dad I'm here."
"How can you ask me to choose between my brother and my niece?"
"I'm not asking."
His cheeks puffed with laughter. "You would have done well here."
He showed them to the guest quarters and sent them around servants to see to their needs, but all Blaze needed was a bed. He slept soundly, yet woke as soon as the help began to bump around preparing for the morning. At least in Galador, you always knew there'd be plenty of tea. Downstairs, he ate crab cakes on toast. As he wiped his mouth, a servant handed him a weighty purse. Blaze grinned. Denny knew how things got done. As soon as it was light enough to get his bearings, he walked into the crisp morning. A quarter mile across the water, smoke hung over the chimney. A few dozen islets scattered this corner of the lake. Lolligan's five-story estate wasn't the biggest on the islands, but it was easy enough to spot. Blaze hopped in a rowboat and paddled over, oars stirring the smell of fresh water with each stroke. A servant met him on Lolligan's dock.
"Are we expecting you?"
"Oh, I doubt it."
Blaze climbed out and stretched his legs. "Unless Lolligan's even spookier than I thought, Jeffers."
Jeffers' jaw dropped.
"Lord Pendulous?"
Blaze put a finger to his lips.
"Shh.
If my last mission was hush-hush, consider this one so quiet that a dog would ask you to speak up."
"I understand, my lord. As much as I am able, when it comes to anything concerning you. Please, follow me."
Jeffers hiked up the steps and circled the building. Around back, a door led to a little used cellar. Inside he lit a lantern, showed Blaze to a chair, and headed back outside, careful to close the door behind him. Blaze considered hiding beside the doorway and leaping out as soon as it opened. He would never have a better chance to take Lolligan by surprise. But the man was around that age where people were apt to drop dead clutching their heart. Lolligan stepped inside, his avian features even sharper in the morning light. He shielded his eyes, adjusting to the darkness, and clumped down the steps.
"Sweet Aron, I thought Jeffers had finally gone senile. What fresh disaster have you brought me this time?"
"None for once."
Blaze bounced from his chair and wrapped the old man in a hug.
"At least nothing that ought to splash back on you."
"Where in all the hells have you been?"
"Eluding Dante."
"So Taya said."
Lolligan backed up the stairs to close the door, then swept the dust from a chair and sat.
"Does your presence mean it's finally safe for you to emerge from hibernation?"
You will be completely unsurprised to learn I'm here to deal with an emergency, which we can get to in a second. For now, tell me everything that's happened. Is Taya all right?
She's fine.
Lolligan smoothed his trim white beard into a point.
Getting out of Setevan, they had a hell of a ride and a bit of a fight, but they made off with the king's payment. We concluded it would be best to lie low for a while. Last 2 months we've been smuggling as much bosson into the capital as we dare.
Given that I haven't heard the unmistakable sound of a crumbling palace, I take it Modigan's fortune remains intact.
As far as I know, but he's been in no hurry to sell off his stock. Even if we're not in position to pop the bubble, we can make it droop.
So, we won't lop off his head, but we may give him a pinch in the neck. Blaze sighed.
I'm sorry I let you down. Indeed. If only you hadn't been hunted through space and time by a monomaniacal nethomancer of hideous power.
Lolligan pulled his coat tighter around his shoulders.
I don't know anything about your present situation, but I do know we could still use you.
What if I could? Blaze said.
But you've become enmeshed in another outlandish contretemps, as is your way. Will you at least give me a hint?
Would you believe me if I said Pocket Cove? Lolligan was silent a moment, then laughed.
Only because it's you. Please, please, tell me you're not here to seek sanctuary from them.
I would never do that to you. On the other hand, you do have a very nice cellar to hide in. At that moment, Blaze sneezed. The space was musty and damp. Do you know Denever, of the Stotts family?
We trade in similar routes.
Heard about his son?
Kel, Lolligan said. Went missing, yes? You aren't involved, are you?
In his disappearance? Of course not. I'm here to find him. Blaze leaned forward. You have to keep this under your tongue, but we think he's been taken by a woman from Narashtavik.
Televand?
You know her. Can you tell me anything about her?
Not much, I'm afraid. She came asking about Denny's interests a few weeks back. Assumed she was looking to butter him up or propose a deal of some kind, but otherwise I didn't think much of it at the time. Then I saw her in town again a couple of days ago.
Blazer's pulse leapt. Where?
Stepping into a carriage around the back of the Rotterdam estate. He's a friend of mine. Want me to check into it for you?
Would you? I'd prefer to keep a low profile until it's time to leap out from the shrubs.
Lolligan nodded. It might help if I knew what all this was about.
Obviously, it's not that I don't trust you. Blaze sighed through his nose. But it's not just about me. The person who brought me here has much more to lose.
Like a favor for you.
The old man grinned.
Don't worry, your new secrets are as safe as your old ones.
As always, thank you. Is Taya in town?
She's in Setevan. Would you like me to send her a letter?
Not now. But next time you write, let her know I'm safe and well. He headed out to the dock and rode to Wending's main passenger piers. Though he'd spent plenty of time in the city, most of it had been limited to ultra-private meetings in Lolligan's cellar. And he had few worries he'd be recognized, either as Lord Pendulous or Blaze Buckler. Even so, as he entered the bustling flow of people stepping off and onto ferries and two-person taxi boats, he made sure his collar was up and his hair was mussed, glad he'd let himself get good and shaggy during his stay in Pocket Cove. He went from taxi-man to taxi-man, describing the woman who called herself Talavand, rustling the boatman's memories with Denny's slush fund. Most knew nothing. Others couldn't come up with more than a vague match for the description. This didn't surprise Blaze. The fact they handled high volumes of traffic was the very reason he'd come to canvass them. At the same time, it was maddening to hear so many possible matches to his search. Even if he could run down each one, and the boatmen rarely remembered where they'd deposited their fares, let alone when, doing so would take days. Min's time here was limited. So perhaps was Cal's.
At midday, he retired to a public house to eat lunch and reassess his approach. Logically, Talavand must be operating from relatively nearby. Close enough to correspond with Denny. And to deliver severed fingers before they'd gone rotten. Almost certainly, she was somewhere in Galador Rift. Probably not in Wending itself, however. Too dangerous. That meant boat travel. Thus his querying of the taxis, whom he'd far from exhausted. He set back to work, including more questions pertinent to her being from Narashtovik. They had their own accent, and tended to dress in more fur, among other distinguishing characteristics. The city was far enough from Galador to make visitors somewhat scarce. This turned up a few leads, which he duly followed up on. Trotting through the sloped streets to call on shops and tradesmen and the city's voluminous library. But by the end of the day, with nothing solid in hand, he returned to Denny's home, more exhausted than the day before. "Make any progress with the blood?" he asked Min as they sat down to eat. "No more than you did at the docks." "I inquired with the messenger," Denny said. "Not surprisingly, the box was brought to him for final delivery by a third party. He had a description of the man, but no name." "And still nothing from Talavand?" Blaze said. Denny poked at his seared whitefish, swirling his fork through the pureed basil sauce. "No. She knows that the longer she waits, the further my will to resist decays." A fine dinner-time conversation. After, they had a couple drinks. But Blaze was even less inclined to talk about himself than Min was, and while he got the impression Denny would have been happy to discuss his enterprise under different circumstances, the man had more on his mind than business. They soon retired to their rooms. Blaze was slow to wake, possibly because he was less than enthused about another day of running up and down the fishy-smelling piers. When he finally rousted himself and went downstairs for tea, there was a letter waiting from Lolligan, requesting his presence as soon as he was able. He gulped down a mug of tea while it was still scalding and rolled straight to Lolligan's. Up on the porch, Jeffers nodded at him and went inside. Blaze headed to the cellar. Lolligan joined him shortly. "I spoke to Rotterdam," Lolligan said. "At first he was a bit cagey, but when I told him it was related to the disappearance, he confirmed Talavand had been to see him." "You mean recently?" He nodded. "Last month he allowed her to see his library. Discussion wandered to the subject of histories, and he mentioned one that snagged her ear. She wanted to buy it, but he'd loaned it to a friend who was away on business in Tatornin. 2 weeks ago, Rotterdam let her know his friend would be back soon. She returned to complete the purchase 4 days ago." "In person? She's either very bold or very obsessed." "There was quite a large sum on the line. He got the impression she was there to confirm the addition for herself." He leaned forward and glanced around, mock conspiratorial. "There's more. When she left, she forgot her coat. It was a few minutes before anyone noticed. Rotterdam dispatched a servant to the piers, but by the time the man got there, her vessel was already ploughing across the lake."
"Tell me he remembers the boat."
Lolligan grinned. "The Blind Eye. Known suitably enough for its discretion." Blaze clapped, the report echoing from the stone walls. "About time I had a bit of luck. Make sure Rotterdam's man gets a raise." He all but ran out of the cellar, then rode into the city so fast it was a wonder his boat didn't take to the air like a rotund wooden eagle. He'd never heard of the Blind Eye, but he easily bought info on its berthage from one of the other boatsmen. It was currently out on the lakes, dropping off a well-heeled passenger. Blaze settled in at a pub on the docks and treated himself to a beer while he waited for his ship to come in. That took all day and half the evening. As dusk encored, with fish breaking the surface to nibble at the few flies alive this time of year, an unmarked sloop slipped up to the pier and tied off.
Blaze finished his beer. Just his third, he needed to stay sharp-witted, and headed toward the blind eye.
A gangplank connected it to the dock. Blaze started up, but a man loomed on the other end.
Sure you're on the right ship.
I'm here to see Captain Kessel, Blaze said. So unless he's left your vessel for another fair lady of the lakes, I'm pretty sure I've got my mark.
Who shall I tell him is here?
Blaze jangled his purse.
Opportunity!
The man snorted and headed toward the single deck at the aft. To avoid attention, Blaze had left his sword at Denny's, but he found himself regretting his caution. He had brought knives, though. He never didn't have knives. The sailor returned, wordlessly gestured Blaze aboard, and led him to the captain's cabin. This was as cramped as they always were, wallpapered with maps of the lakes and the channels connecting them. No other records were visible. Blaze closed the door, but declined a seat on the bench shelf that ran along the wall.
I'm here about one of your passengers.
What passengers?
Captain Kessel was younger than Blaze expected, maybe no older than Blaze himself. He had a burn scar on the left side of his jaw, and looked as lean and mean as a lake pike.
Just one. A woman named Talavand.
The man regarded him blankly.
I repeat, what passengers? This is a fishing trawler.
Captain, while I have nothing but respect for the value you place on your passenger's privacy...
Do you? Then turn around and walk off my boat.
Blaze stepped forward. One of your non-existent passengers kidnapped the family of someone close to me, putting me in the unfortunate position of giving a shit. I can see that if I tried to bribe you, you would laugh at me. If I threatened you, you'd probably try to stab me, and I'd have to kill you before I learned what I want to know.
Kessel sniffed. Then it sounds like walking away is even smarter than it was a minute ago.
Yep, Blaze said. But I never was too smart.
They eyed each other. Blaze made no move. But Kessler was canny enough to pick up something in his face. The corner of the captain's mouth twitched. His backside was leaned against a compact table thick with charts. He lunged forward, driving a two-pronged drafting compass at Blaze's throat. Blaze stepped forward and to the man's right, draping his left hand over the man's incoming wrist and guiding it past his body. In the same movement, he slammed a right hook into the side of the captain's head. The man sprawled to the ground, still holding his wrist. Blaze stomped Kessel's shoulder and twisted his arm until the compass dropped from his slackening grasp.
"Despite all the evidence to the contrary, I respect you," Blaze said, breathing hard. "Now respect that I can break your arm with a twitch."
The pressure of Blaze's weight on his shoulder smushed Kessel's face to the boards of the floor.
"Bones heal. When my crew gets to you, your spine won't."
"The woman I want is a kidnapper. If she doesn't get what she wants, I expect to discover she's a murderer as well. I doubt that means much to you, because you've got your own code. Following that to the end, that's what you value."
He laughed.
"Are you about to tell me how we're both the same?"
"I don't need to tell you that, do I?"
Kessel's shoulder relaxed beneath his foot.
"Get to the point or let me up so I can finish what I started."
It was Blazer's turn to laugh.
"Staying silent doesn't protect your code. All it protects is someone who deserves my wrath."
"Buy me a beer."
"A beer?"
"Buy me a beer,"
Kessel repeated slowly,
"and I'll drop you right in her doorstep."
Blaze let go of his wrist and stepped back.
"It was the bit about the wrath, wasn't it?"
The captain sat, rubbing his wrist while he rotated his shoulder.
"I figured you were about to hit me with a sob story."
"Sob story? You thought I'd torture you like that?"
"Maybe we aren't as alike as I thought."
Blaze wasn't entirely sure Kessel wasn't pulling his leg to buy an opportune moment to knife him in the back, but the man seemed relaxed, unruffled. He finished up his business on the blind eye, then jogged down the gangplank and walked shoulder to shoulder with Blaze to the pier. All told, it wound up being well more than a pier, and as they talked and joked, Blaze kept in mind the idea that Kessel was lulling him into drunken complacency, but his body language remained right. Blaze got the impression he just wanted to get off the water for a couple hours, or to kill time until his preferred hour to act. This turned out to be nearly 10 o'clock. Blaze would have liked to get a word to Min, but figured it was better for her to worry about him than to endanger his chances of locating Cal. Anyway, that was a bit presumptuous. She might not worry in the slightest. This was what he did, after all. Kessel ambled back to his ship. With minimal orders, his crew shoved off and turned the boat around, steering north across the lake. In Blaze's experience with captains, many of them preferred to embed themselves in their cabins while the ship went about the tedious business of getting from one port to the next. But Kessel stood up front, watching the water.
"On the lookout for pirates," Blaze said. "They know better than that," Kessel said. "It's the night. I like to watch it." "That's all well and good until the night looks back."
Like all three lakes in Galador, this one stretched north to south, and the blind eye sailed up its long eastern shore, keeping itself a few hundred feet from land. Wending was by far the largest city on the lake, but lanterns gleamed from numerous fishing villages content to live at their own pace. Halfway up the lake, a mitten-shaped bay protruded to the east, leaving a sharp peninsula wrapped around its northern edge. Steep hills surrounded the peninsula, swooping up to Galador's short but craggy mountains, protecting it from overland approach. What little land was usable overlooked a sheltered bay. Blaze wasn't surprised to see the peninsula had been claimed by sprawling estates with high roofs and tended grounds. The blind eye drifted to a stop within bowshot of its point. Kessel pointed to the home on the tip of the peninsula.
"See that? Count two to the right. That's where we brought the woman."
Blaze leaned over the railing, as if getting a foot closer would reveal her waiting in the darkness. The grounds were bordered with 20-foot stands of bamboo. A dock extended from the shore. Behind it, the land jumped 30 feet to a plateau housing an L-shaped manor, with towers rising from each of its three corners. Lights burned in its central tower.
"You're positive," Blaze said.
Kessel smirked.
"Imagine you've made a business transporting people who don't want their movements known. Sometimes these people think your word, your reputation, it isn't enough. They think maybe they should go back and make sure their tracks are covered."
"Thus, if they try anything foolish, you like to know where to hit back."
The captain nodded.
"Soon enough. Thanks for your trouble.
I can't say more, but I'm sure you'll be rewarded. Handsomely.
Just keep my ship and crew out of it."
Blaze stuck out his hand. "My lips are sealed." Kessel brought about the ship and hove toward Wending. At the city docks, Blaze jogged to his rowboat and returned to Denny's. It was after 1 in the morning, but the others were awake, waiting for him. They convened in the business den.
"I think I found him," Blaze said.
Min pressed her fist to her mouth, eyes bright. Denny cried out and crushed Blaze in a hug.
"You know the peninsula up north," Blaze said, once he'd extricated himself. "Talavan's operating from a home there."
"How do you know this?" Denny said.
"I promised my source I wouldn't say, but I consider him highly reliable."
Blaze lowered himself to a chair.
"Do you know anyone who lives there?"
"Sure. Many of the city's wealthy consider themselves too great to live in the city, and prefer to isolate themselves on Unba Peninsula. Should I pay a call?"
"In the morning. Go take a look at the place. Get an idea of what we're up against. We can move that same night."
Denny held his glass to his stomach.
You're talking about an attack.
Do you have a problem with that? Blay said.
None.
They talked out a few more details, then Denny retired to catch what sleep he could before morning. Once he was gone, Min said, Do you know what it's supposed to feel like?
What's that?
Blay said. Blood hunting? If that's what you call it.
Dante described it as a pressure in his head. It got stronger when he was pointed in the right direction, and the closer he got to his mark.
Blaze smiled.
Feel something?
I'm not sure.
She laughed a little.
I guess that means yes, but I don't know what to do with it yet.
Keep trying. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
If things get nuts and they try to escape with him, that skill would come in quite handy.
The next day was a busy one for everyone but Blaze. By the time he arrived downstairs for tea, Denny was already gone.
Min was holed up in a room with the finger, plying the nether.
Servants came and went. Jinsen, the bodyguard, returned with 5 men, 3 of whom Blaze didn't recognize. They stood in the yard, pointing here and there, maneuvering themselves through formations and arrangements. None bore arms, but earlier, Blaze had seen a servant lug 3 long cloth bundles up from the cellar, along with a chest that almost certainly contained armor. Denny had taken his favorite sloop, but his docks remained busy in his absence, with sailors adjusting and mending the rigging of a sleek cutter whose railings alternated between open gaps and closed planks, like the crenels and merlins atop a castle.
Blaze had half a mind to check in with Lolligan, but the tea baron turned rebel would have sent over a letter if anything new had come up.
In the interest of not mucking anything up on the day of the assault, he procured a 2nd sword from one of the servants. It had been months since he'd used 2, and he was happy to burn the hours with practice.
Early that afternoon, Denny returned on his sloop and summoned Blaze, Jinsen, and Min to the tower overlooking the lake.
I took a stroll around the peninsula, he said. It appears that Tullivan's home is patrolled. In the middle of the day.
Jinsen laughed wryly. Why would you need daylight patrols at peaceful old Umber Peninsula?
We don't have to assault them. We could offer to swap the almanac for Cal. That's what they want, isn't it?
If we let them know we know how to get to them, they're apt to get spooked.
I have no intention of letting them escape unpunished, Denny said. Not after what they've done to Cal. But I thought I would suggest it, in case you thought I was crazy.
Blaze bit his lip. Either way, we should act today.
We act tonight.
Denny turned to Jinsen. Have you worked out a plan?
With the help of a quill and paper, Jinsen sketched it out for them. They would land their main force down the peninsula, then move to the ridge above Tullivan's manor. Meanwhile, the cutter would position itself off the house's dock, sealing off escape by water. Once the troops were assembled on the ridge, Jinsen would lead a team into the manor and clear it room by room, concentrating any captives they took into one room while they searched for Cal and extracted him. Then they could take one of Tullivan's own vessels out to the cutter and sail home. As Jinsen laid this out, Min and Blaze exchanged glances. At last she could stand no more.
All you have to do is get me inside, Min said. I can find Cal and get him out without spilling a single drop of blood.
It was Denny and Jinsen's turn to frown at each other. Denny lowered his eyes to the map.
This involves your sorcery. They'll never know I'm there.
Denny rubbed his beard.
Min, I can't let you put your life on the line for me. Because I'm a woman. Because you're my niece.
A few seconds of silence ensued. Blaze leaned over the table.
She's been training me. I can assure you that if you want to get your son home, she's the most powerful weapon we've got.
At least 3 emotions fought for control of Denny's face. At last, love of his son, or respect for his niece, won out.
Tell us what you can do.
She did so. The two men listened, stunned. As soon as she finished, Jensen recovered, amending his plan and leaving the old one up as backup. He then left to drill the men in accordance with the revised strategy. Denny went to consult with the sailors of his cutter.
I won't insult you by asking if you're ready, Blaze said.
Min gazed on the shining legs.
Do you do this sort of thing a lot?
Enough that my parents' ghosts must have died all over again from worry.
Then I'm glad you came with me.
Though their exact strategy had been drawn up on the spur of the moment, Denny had been planning for potential hostilities before Blaze and Min had arrived in Galador. By nightfall, all his assets sat ready. At midnight, Blaze boarded the sloop, along with Denny, Min, Jensen, and five other men-at-arms. Four bowmen boarded the large cutter. The two boats launched at the same time, but the sloop outpaced the other vessel, making port in the underarm of the peninsula, while the cutter was still 10 minutes from its final position. Exactly as planned. The soldiers debarked and headed up a path that ran the length of the peninsula's ridge. A rooster crowed in the hills. As they passed a darkened home, a dog barked, chain rattling. Otherwise it was quiet. And as the cutter came to rest a few houses down from Talavan's, Blaze and the troops hunkered down in a ditch overlooking her home. Jensen murmured to the men, making last-minute reminders of their next move. Before he had the chance to finish, Min stood bolt upright, slapping her hand to her forehead.
"Stop everything," she said. "We're at the wrong house."
Chapter 23. After searching so long for any knowledge about the object of his quest, Dante climbed the stairs in a daze. Horace took them to a cozy room with thick rugs, a few low tables, and sunken nooks. Two narrow floor-to-ceiling windows looked out on the cavern. Horace closed the glassless windows' shutters. Given that they were already in a giant cave, this did little to diminish the light, but it would keep their voices from carrying. He settled his lantern into a sconce beside the door and sat in the middle of the room. The others settled down on the rugs.
"I will begin with an apology," Horace said. "I expect I know less than you would like. As compensation, I can explore two paths for you. The first is the story of the Black Star as it has always been told, and the second is our understanding of how it manifests itself in the world."
He looked up from his hands.
"How much do you know? Are you familiar with the cycle of Jerun?"
"Not all my friends are," Dante said. "Best to start from the beginning."
"Do you know the story of Aron's Mill?"
"At first Aron's Mill ground the ether that bound the world. There was harmony in the heavens and on earth. No hunger, no death. Then mankind grew too many. The ground broke under our weight. Aron's Mill fell and cracked. He returned it to the sky but couldn't fix it. It no longer ground ether, but nether. And nether brought death."
"Yet it also returns men and women to the heavens. Turned a broken line into a circle."
Horace waited for an argument, then went on.
"But when Aron restored his mill, it had a wobble. With each year that passed, the wobble worsened, until all who looked up could see it, and feared that it would fall again. If the fall repeated, the floods would too, and perhaps this time the mill would shatter beyond repair. No more nether, no more life. They prayed, begged, but Aron did nothing. Some said he was still angered that his mill had been broken to begin with. Others thought he had decided to bring his cycle to a close. The rains began. Crops and men were washed out to sea. Still the people prayed, and still Aron did nothing. Then his mortal daughter, Jerun,
thought that if he refused to listen to the living, perhaps he'd listen to the dead. She put a knife into her heart. When the Nether came, she followed it to him, and demanded he set his mill to true before all was lost. For the first time in centuries, he spoke. He said, "How do you find a black star in the night sky?" Jaren went to look, but the sky is vast. The world would be long drowned before she found it. She tried looking in the shadows of stars, thinking it might be there, but found nothing. Thinking this black star might be a hole, she scattered sand across the sky and waited for it to fall, but it rolled away forever. The seas crept from their shores, swallowing the cities. "How do you find a black star in the night sky?" her father had said, and then she knew. "You bring light to the dark." Aron gave the measures, so she snuck into his tower and pulled half the weights from the scales. The sun leapt forward, catching the stars before they'd slid behind the world. But a single one remained visible, like a hole in the sky. She showed it to Aron. He took it up, and she saw that it was Nether that had been lost to him. He sent one third of it to restore the inundated lands, one third to prop up his mill, and one third to return Jaren from death to life. The mill turned on, humans rebuilt, and thrived. Horace cleared his throat. That is the story from the cycle of Jaren. At Dirison, we end the story a little differently. But Jaren was afraid, for if the black star ever came back, she knew it wouldn't allow itself to be caught like that again.
"The Norren have a story like that," Dante said.
"Norren?"
"Another people I've met. But you said you had more than a story. That you know how it manifests to the world."
"It's a strange thing," Horace said. "Search hard enough and you'll see it mentioned many times. Always indirectly, by people commenting on the records of others. You're left with dark reflections in a broken mirror. Many years ago, my people found a tablet that had survived where all the other records had not. It said, 'The star is not the mill. The mill wobbles. The star always returns to its place.'"
He gave Dante a significant look, placing Dante in that unique situation where he knew he was expected to follow the path set before him, yet had no idea where to plant his feet.
"That's it," Dante said. "You see, black star is discovered where it was last used."
"But any records of its last usage are long lost."
"So it would seem."
Horace stood and bowed his head. "I hope I have been of help." Aware the others would want to talk amongst themselves, he left them, closing the door behind him. Lou just shook his head. "I'm starting to think this whole quest is nothing but people chasing their own shadows." "When you find a shard of pottery by the river, you can't know the shape of the object it belonged to," Dante said. "But if you keep gathering pieces, bit by bit, you build your jug."
"In this case, the river appears to be the entire known world. Probably some unknown parts, too."
Somber folded his arms.
"When words fail, check the mouth that spoke them. Why would Casey give us what we want when she doesn't have any reason to think we'll keep helping her?"
Dante shrugged.
"Because she has no leverage." "She knows more. She's withholding.
She'll offer to tell us in exchange for ongoing assistance."
"Why don't we head back to the Wodens?" C said. "That's where the lights were, right? Don't you think that's a pretty obvious sign where Selin's going to come back?" The Norrin saw lights in their lands, too, Dante said. Anyway, we can't leave Wesley yet. We've only begun the search.
She laughed loudly.